Ascent Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents GRIT, HBR Emotional Intelligence Series, by Harvard Business Review. Narrated by Lauren Peterson and Derek Dysart. Publisher's note. This audiobook has bonus material. Please contact whomever you purchase this audiobook from to request the material. All figures referenced in this audiobook can be found in the bonus material. 1. To build grit, go back to basics. An interview with Shannon Huffman Poulsen by Kurt Nickisch. The concept of grit has been growing in popularity in recent years. It's an essential quality for facing stress, pushing through difficulties, and overcoming obstacles both at work and in life. But not everyone has grit, nor do they understand how to build it. Shannon Huffman Poulsen knows all about the kind of mental and emotional fortitude that so many experts say people need. She was one of the first women to pilot the Apache attack helicopter in the U.S. Army, has launched a successful corporate and consulting career, and is the author of The Grit Factor: Courage, Resilience, and Leadership in the Most Male-Dominated Organization in the World. In this interview, she discusses how to build grit like a muscle by recognizing your story, understanding your core purpose, and forcing yourself to do hard things. Kurt Nickisch. First and foremost, what does grit mean to you? Shannon Huffman Poulsen. The way that I have defined it over the years is a dogged determination in the face of difficult circumstances. Angela Duckworth of the University of Pennsylvania has defined grit as passion and perseverance toward long-term goals, which I also love. I will say that in today's context, where the future is very uncertain, where the horizon is especially unclear, and where we're all working in these environments that are much more ambiguous, I have a slight preference for my own definition. Let's talk about your personal experience and understanding of grit. Where did it come from? It's something that I grew up talking about with my dad especially. It's the term that we would use for pushing through and doing hard things. That has become an important part of who I am and how I've approached life and challenges. As I got older, I also understood that it's something that not everybody had the exposure to and that many, many people were looking for. How did your father instill this in you? A lot of the ways that we're able to relay a message or a concept, both as parents and managers, is through stories and through questions. There's a story that I tell. I was on the soccer field and my parents were there cheering. This was not the kind of hyper-competitive soccer that people play now. It was girls' club soccer. We were all about 9 or 10 years old. There was a young woman playing offense on the other team who would just crush the field. We would always part like the Red Sea as she came charging at us, and she would score every single time. I remember after one game, my dad asked me, "Why don't you just run back at her?" That was a mind-boggling concept. But the next time we played against that team, she came charging down my side of the field, and I went charging back at her. We collided at full speed. She never charged my side of the field again. There is a combination of things there, but part of it was the willingness to go into something that I was afraid of, that I knew was going to be difficult, that I knew was, in that case, going to hurt, and be willing to do it anyway. You faced some of this in the military as well. Tell me about your experience facing obstacles as an aspiring pilot in the U.S. Army. I certainly didn't go into it understanding the challenges. I went into the military, and into Army attack aviation specifically, because I wanted to do something hard and exciting. I was 21 years old. I don't know what you know when you're 21, but fortunately not enough to dissuade you from what might lie ahead. I approached Army attack aviation with enthusiasm for the opportunity and the job. Of course, once I got into that position and saw the challenges I would face, especially as one of the first women in the role, it was a very different scenario than any that I had ever found myself in. It offered a lot less support and assurance than I had grown up with, for sure. What did you encounter along the way? When I was at Duke University, I was an English major and in the Army ROTC. The assumption was that I would then receive my commission in the National Guard going forward. At the end of my senior year, I drove out to Raleigh, North Carolina to meet with the state aviation officer and receive my assignment for the years ahead. I remember reporting to a colonel who was probably in his late 30s. He was behind this immense desk that seemed as wide as the room, with shiny windows going up the back. I stood at attention and saluted and tried not to shake too much. He had me take a seat, and we exchanged a couple of pleasantries in a very formal sort of a way before the exchange that I will never forget. He stopped mid-sentence, leaned back in his chair, looked down his nose at me, and said, "You realize, cadet, that you will never fly an attack aircraft." I recognized this comment for what it was meant to be, which was small and mean, because at the time, in 1993, attack aircraft weren't open to women to fly. But I also understood, in my extremely nascent military career, that there are times when the only thing you can say is, "Yes, sir." So I did. Then I went back to the Duke ROTC detachment and requested a transfer out of the National Guard and into active duty. Later that spring, Congress lifted the combat exclusion clause for aviation. Suddenly, everything in the inventory was open to women and men to fly, and I reported to Fort Rucker later that year. The moment with the colonel, that was a moment where a lot of people would stop, right? Or accept the powers that be? A big part of what begins the grit-forming process is deciding that you are going to be the person in charge of your own story, not someone else. You are going to be the person that decides what your narrative will be. You can't choose the raw material, but you can decide how you're going to use it. Many people don't do that. How do you take that first step? It's about focusing on your end goal and what your purpose is. When you're focused on that core purpose, that you are going to succeed, that you are going to contribute in this meaningful way, that allows you to not concentrate on the obstacles as much. It's a choice of where you put your focus. Why is focusing on your own story so important? The way we understand information really is in the form of a story. Thinking back to make sense of our own stories, to understand the places where we grew, to understand our strengths, to understand where we overcame obstacles, becomes part of how we can approach future challenges or even current ones. It's thinking back and saying, "Hey, look at how I got through this really hard time. I either developed that strength or I realized there was a way around this hurdle." Doing that can help you find ways to negotiate the challenges that you're facing today, and that's critical work. You aren't just making sense of the raw material that you're given. You're looking at how you turned the raw material of your life into your story. Because you get to choose. You get to say either, "I was a victim of this circumstance," or, "I was able to overcome this. I was able to push through." When you do that work and you decide what that arc of that story of your life is going to be, then you can borrow from the strengths of that. You can understand your values and how to go forward in connection with those values in a way that strengthens you for what you might be facing today or will be facing in the future. You know your own story very well. How do you help people figure out what their story is so that they know what to commit to? There are a number of tactical exercises that I suggest. One of them is to start with what is sometimes called a journey line or a lifeline. Look at your major life experiences. Really own and understand the raw material of them and get that down on paper. Then study what you've written, aiming to understand how that relates to and informs your core values and your core purpose. Another exercise that I love drills down into your core purpose. This is pretty deep internal work. It's not back-of-the-napkin analysis. It requires time and space for you to think about and to think about again and again. This exercise was developed by Toyota and is called the 5 Whys. Ask yourself why you're doing something. Not one time, but 5 times. A why for each answer you come up with. Drill down into that deep, deep why that's not specific to the job, that's not specific to the task, but that is truly connected to who you are as an individual. You've got to make that strong connection that is uniquely yours before you can apply it to whatever the task is, whatever the company's missions and values and goals are. For me, it's service and serving others. Growing up, we made food for people who didn't have enough. We visited retirement homes. The concept of contribution and giving back became a very big part of who I am. Connecting to that purpose allows me to get through times that are difficult, frustrating, or both. Was there a time in your military career where you faced obstacles and recalling that core idea of service helped you get through them? The best example I have for this is maybe one of the least exciting, but also one of the most relatable. When I first was assigned to Fort Bragg, North Carolina, it was my first duty assignment and I was 23 years old. I was qualified to pilot the Apache helicopter. I was excited. I was ready to fly and to lead. But when I arrived at the 229th Aviation Regiment, there were two battalions. There were 120 male pilots, and I was the only female pilot. I was assigned not to a platoon where I would be flying and using the craft that I had just learned, but as the assistant to the assistant operations officer. A desk job. Exactly. And not typing up, for example, operations orders where you're getting into the meat of things, but writing the appendices to the operations orders. I was brought up believing that you do the best job you can, so I did the best job I could. I had great feedback, and I went to the captain I was working for and said, "Listen, sir, I'm going to keep doing the best job I can at this work, but I wonder when a platoon might open up." That captain looked at me and said, "Lieutenant, the Army doesn't owe you anything." I kept on doing my work, and then at some point we were all brought in on a Saturday to do work together as an operations shop for no apparent reason. The major that we all worked for looked over at me and joked, "Don't worry, Lieutenant, you'll be married by the time you're 25. I did not say, "Yes, sir," as I had to that colonel back in Raleigh. I went to see the major the next week and said, "Sir, I'm going to keep doing the best job I can at what I've been assigned, but I think that I can do more." He looked kind of surprised. Then he assigned me one additional duty after the other, and finally I took that first flight platoon. I think back on those times and about how they apply to the people and companies I have the chance to talk to across the country and around the world. I talk to people all the time who don't know how to push back when somebody says, "The Army doesn't owe you anything," or "You'll be married by the time you're 25. They just think that's where they're stuck. I strongly believe that there's an opportunity for us to push through those things by owning our story, by drilling down into core purpose, and by learning to have the courage to ask for what you want again and again. Every single opportunity that I had in the military, I had to ask for. I had to earn it first, of course, but then I had to ask for it. And that's an important lesson in that whole process. How do you become better at grit? When you have setbacks or something gets in your way, how do you develop grit then? There are three different phases. The commit phase is what we've already talked about, owning your own story and drilling down to core purpose. The second phase is learn, and the third, launch. In that second phase of learning, a few things are important, and this goes to your question. One of them is developing your team or drawing your circle, because the people who don't support you should be outside of it. But you need to have a team. None of us do this alone. That is critical when times get tough. Is that a misunderstanding of grit, that it's an individual quality? Sometimes, a lot of us have had experiences where if we want to get it done well, we do it ourselves. But both the mentality and the reality of that aren't sustainable. It might be something we can do in the short term, but it's not a sustainable solution for the long run. When you talk about grit, and this goes back to Angela Duckworth's definition, you're talking about passion and perseverance toward long-term goals. Or if it's dogged determination, there's a sustainability aspect to that which has to come into play. You can't do it yourself. You've got to build that team. But there are very specific ways that you can build grit and resilience. I borrow a lot from the Army's Master Resilience Training Program, which was developed at the University of Pennsylvania as part of their positive psychology program. Decades of research have gone into this, and there are very specific things that you can do. To put one of them in a nutshell, to get better at doing hard things, you need to do hard things. It sounds almost trite to say, but you take one step. You challenge yourself a little bit more the next time, and the next, and the next. That is truly how you build up a muscle for grit and resilience, and it's absolutely something that is accessible to every single one of us. Grit versus resilience. What's the difference? by Courtney Cashman. Grit and resilience are often used interchangeably, but are they the same thing? Not really. Angela Duckworth, author of the best-selling book Grit, famously defines grit as passion and perseverance toward long-term goals. Psychologist Heidi Grant offers another take, describing grit as a willingness to commit to long-term goals and to persist in the face of difficulty. Others have their own definitions. But the consistent theme running through these interpretations is one of hard determination and persistence, pushing through in the face of challenges and hardships. Resilience is a bit more nuanced. Andrea Ovens, former editor at Harvard Business Review, defines resilience as the ability to recover from setbacks, adapt well to change, and keep going in the face of adversity. In other words, it's not just moving forward, but also picking yourself up after you fall. It's having the fortitude to keep going, while also analyzing what happened and making appropriate changes for the future. Resilience requires the use of a growth mindset, a concept pioneered by psychologist and Stanford professor Carol Dweck, where you view obstacles and setbacks as learning experiences. So where grit helps you work through difficult situations and even endure the toughest, resilience helps you bounce back and become even stronger than before. Both grit and resilience are essential traits for success at work. Fortunately, they can also both be learned.
2. Gauging Your Grit by Thomas H. Lee and Angela Duckworth. How much grit do you have? To see how gritty you are compared with a pool of more than 5,000 American adults, respond to the following prompts, assigning each a number between 1 and 5, where 1 is very much like me, and 5 is not at all like me. Tally your score and divide by 10. Don't overthink your answers or try to guess the right answer. The more honestly you respond, the more accurate the results. 1. New ideas and projects sometimes distract me from previous ones. 2. Setbacks don't discourage me. I don't give up easily. 3. I often set a goal but later choose to pursue a different one. 4. I am a hard worker. 5. I have difficulty maintaining my focus on projects that take more than a few months to complete. Remember, assign each a number between 1 and 5, where 1 is very much like me, and 5 is not at all like me. Six. I finish what I begin. 7. My interests change from year to year. 8. I am diligent. I never give up. 9. I have been obsessed with a certain idea or project for a short time but later lost interest. 10. I have overcome setbacks to conquer an important challenge. Compare your results with the following percentiles to find out if you have more or less grit than average. If you scored at least a 4.5, for instance, you are grittier than 90% of test takers. A grit score of 2.5 is a percentile of 10%. A grit score of 3.0 is a percentile of 20%. A grit score of 3.3 is a percentile of 30%. Grit score 3.5 is a percentile 40%. Grit score 3.8, percentile 50%. Grit score 3.9, percentile 60%. A grit score of 4.1 is a percentile of 70%. Grit score 4.3, percentile 80%. Grit score 4.5 is percentile 90%. Grit score 4.7 is a percentile of 95%. And a grit score of 4.9 is a percentile of 99%. 3. How to deal with high-pressure situations at work. By Tomas Camaro Premusic.
Many of the things we're proud to achieve in life are the product not just of our talent and effort, but also our ability to handle pressure.
From studying for exams to preparing for job interviews to giving a big speech or presentation, it's hard to conceive of any career-defining moments that aren't peppered with pressure. One of the oldest findings in modern psychology is that a moderate amount of pressure can actually boost performance. This is why top athletes will generally perform better in competitions than in training, and why professional musicians will be more motivated if they're in front of an audience than rehearsing at home. In general, the more skilled you are at something, the more you're able to translate external or situational pressure into a performance-enhancing ingredient. That said, when pressure levels exceed our optimal threshold, they can negatively impact our performance. They do so mostly by hijacking our focus and attention away from the task and onto our negative emotions, lowering our confidence, and causing stress and anxiety. For example, research found that up to 60% of students experience test anxiety during exams, and a whopping 93% of people feel anxious in job interviews. Then there is the fear of public speaking, which ranks as one of the top phobias in the modern world. What then can you do to improve your ability to deal with pressure, or at least avoid choking under it in critical career moments? Here are four science-based recommendations that can help. Know your threshold.
Humans are a psychologically diverse species. One of the traits that makes each of us unique is our ability to deal with stress. Some call this emotional intelligence. Others call it grit or resilience. The most widely used academic term for this trait is emotional stability. Leaving labels aside, this trait enhances your ability to cope with pressure, making you more cool-headed and less emotionally reactive. Regardless of your individual personality, the first step to managing high-pressure situations is understanding your stress tolerance level. Practical tips for building self-awareness include getting feedback from trusted colleagues and friends, evaluating your performance under different degrees of pressure, paying attention to your emotional reactions in potentially triggering situations, and taking a personality assessment, like the one found in Chapter 2. An easy first step is to pick one or two trusted colleagues and ask, "Do you think I perform well under pressure? Do I look nervous or tense in high-stakes situations? Do you see any changes in my behavior when I'm under calm or high-pressure situations? Do I generally seem calm and composed to you?" The more people you ask, the better the sense you will get of your reputation for dealing with stress and pressure. Your colleagues may even point out specific situations that elicit your stress response, perhaps ones you've never noticed before. Any feedback that tells you something about you that you A. didn't know and B. needed rather than wanted to hear is useful feedback. Fundamentally, knowing your personal pressure triggers will help you avoid them or practice managing your reactions in those moments. Identify your pressure triggers and practice. Once you have a better sense of your personality and how it affects or relates to your propensity to deal with pressure, you should be better able to identify the exact triggers that exceed your default comfort levels.
Do you get stressed by a high workload or looming deadlines? Does failing to meet your social or family obligations make you anxious? Are there things about your lifestyle, like an unhealthy diet or conflicts with your romantic partner, work colleagues, or relatives that weigh on you? While your overall potential to handle pressure will depend primarily on your personality, regardless of how calm or reactive you are, there will be particular situations that evoke more negative reactions than others, and these are very personal and individual. For instance, you may be someone who is never stressed at work but gets easily annoyed by family, or someone who enjoys working with others but is easily stressed by their boss. Fortunately, we can all learn to minimize situations that put too much pressure on us by planning, prioritizing, picking our battles, and going outside our comfort zones within reason. That is, without going over the tipping point. As with any skill or ability, practice is key, yet it's generally underrated as a means to mitigate and prevent pressure, including on recruitment tests, job interviews, and presentations. Research shows that practice improves the performance in all these instances, mostly by mitigating anxiety. For example, if you know that your boss is a source of stress for you, assess how you can change your interactions with them. When communicating with your boss, pick a medium you prefer, in person, email, Slack, Zoom, etc., and the format of the interaction. Schedule a one-on-one meeting in advance so you can prepare, rehearse, and focus. Establish a few points you want to cover in these moments to get what you need to do your job well, what they expect, what you need to deliver, and how you need to communicate. You may also want to try engaging with your boss on a more casual social basis, such as grabbing lunch or having a virtual coffee. Get to know each other on an informal basis, break the ice, and establish a healthy rapport. In general, planning ahead of time and establishing communication norms with the people who stress you out will increase the familiarity and predictability of your interactions and decrease the stress and anxiety you feel around them. This is true even for stressful situations that don't revolve around specific people, like public speaking or job interviews. The more predictable you can make the situation, the less stress you will feel. Use these strategies to help you cope in the moment. There will obviously be situations in which pressure is unavoidable and your only option is to just move forward. Research shows that if you turn the following practices into daily or weekly habits, your ability to manage pressure when it comes on quickly will improve. Breathing exercises, better sleep quality, particularly the night before a high-pressure event, mindfulness and meditation, physical exercise, and thinking techniques such as cognitive reappraisal, whereby you learn to reinterpret a stressful situation as less stressful. Because caffeine heightens mental arousal, which can worsen anxiety, avoid having too many coffees or energy drinks before a big event. The pressure you feel at any given moment is caused largely by your own thoughts, ideas, and interpretations of things. This is why two people will experience different levels of pressure in the same situation, and why a fast heartbeat could signal either intense physical activity or anxiety. The difference is not what your body does, but what your mind thinks. Pressure and stress, just like anger or happiness, are mostly states of mind. When stress shows up unexpectedly despite your other efforts, you can de-emphasize the seriousness of the situation by focusing less on yourself, finding something or someone else to focus on, trying to enjoy certain aspects of the situation, and leveraging effective self-presentation, such as showing humor, honesty, or vulnerability. If you are nervous during a job interview, for instance, you may be better off admitting it right away than trying to hide it or fake confidence. Saying something like, "I'm really sorry, but my nerves are getting to me right now. Forgive me if I take a few deep breaths to relax," may be a better tactic in gaining sympathy than denial or deception. Once you regain your composure, continue to lean on the tactic of honesty. Speak about your...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?